While we are more or less on music, and before we move on to studying, there is one more incident that bears telling, if for no other reason than it provides a lesson that an astute person would take to heart for life. Happily, I wasn't all that astute. There was, when I went to Chicago, a singing teacher of some reputation named Dudley Buck. In November of 1933, A.J. wrote suggesting that I should take lessons with Mr. Buck. He made quite a case for the continuing study and enjoyment of music. LaGuardia, mayor-elect of New York, he wrote, gets his chief recreation from music. Charles M. Schwab, president of Bethlehem Steel, plays the pipe organ and has a director of music in his Riverside Drive home. And U.S. Secretary of Treasury Woodin gets his chief recreation in composing, playing string instruments, etc. A.J. urged me to see Dudley Buck and get him started at $5 per two lessons per week without skimping time or effort. I did indeed see Dudley Buck and was accepted as a pupil for a total of three lessons. At the end of the third lesson, Mr. Buck did not make an appointment for the fourth. Instead, he told me that I should tell my father that he was wasting his money. I was relieved. The obvious moral in such a situation is that I should restrict my singing to the bathtub, or maybe the church choir. However, for all these years, I have gotten a lot of pleasure, and, who knows, may have given some by singing in public. Mr. Buck saved my father some money, but he didn't quell my love for singing. On a more positive note, I also got involved in drama. When I was cast as the blind man in He Came Seeing, I went over to the School for the Blind and researched the part. Later, in a play called Pawns, I was the father of a Russian family being mobilized for the army. The plays did well. One of them won a Chicago area competition, and one was broadcast over NBC on Saturday afternoon. Generally, a more satisfying experience than promoting Mr. Jackson. So far as studying was concerned, the curriculum was what you would expect at a YMCA college. We had courses in YMCA administration, character education, and community organization. There were a lot of courses that bordered on sociology. They dealt with group structure and interaction. There were also physical education courses, including gym and, as you might expect in Chicago, snow skiing and tobogganing. Those were, in terms of what would be expected of us after graduation, practical courses. There was, in the area of recreation, a game that may be peculiar to George Williams or to Chicago. It was called Kill 'Em Quick, which will give you some idea of the objective of the game. It was played on a basketball court and was a combination of basketball, football, and rugby. The stated objective was to take the ball from the center of the floor and get it in the basket, regardless of the difficulties, usually physical, that the other team put in your way. My Kill 'Em Quick days were abruptly ended when I had a high-speed encounter with a parallel bar that was bolted to the floor just beyond the edge of the court. When they finally stopped the bleeding, they discovered that I had a deviated septum. I have never recommended Kill 'Em Quick as a recreational opportunity for my friends. We also had more academic courses, such as the religious drama course taught by Dr. Fred Eastman of the Chicago Theological Seminary. Everything there was a new experience and a challenge, and I enjoyed it. The social life at George Williams centered around the on-campus housing and the church, not only because of the nature of the school, but because nobody had much money. I was a member of the Hyde Park Baptist Church, and the Sunday evening discussions there were a large part of my social and my religious life. I did graduate from George Williams, although largely by the grace of the faculty and the administration. I was pursuing, rather successfully, a degree in group science, the degree the college had for budding YMCA secretaries. In my final year, however, I hit a snag. In fact, I failed a required course. It appeared that I was not going to graduate, despite the fact that the entire Fletcher family had planned a trip to Chicago to witness the graduation and to visit the World's Fair. Before I got around to telling my mother and father the bad news, someone in the administration discovered that I was eligible for a degree, a Bachelor of Association Science. The fact that the school no longer offered such a degree did not create a large problem. On the 5th of June, 1934, I became, in front of my parents and a lot of other people, a Bachelor of Association Science, probably the last one to be graduated from George Williams. There were two other Chicago events that had a lasting effect in my life and the lives of the other people involved. One was the establishment of the Phalanx Club. The South Chicago YMCA served a lot of teenage boys who came from families that were suffering from the Depression. Not only did the boys not have jobs, a lot of their fathers didn't. They needed something more from the Y than a place to play basketball or swim. So we started a teenage boys club, which became affiliated with the Phalanx Clubs. The idea was to emphasize values, teach decision-making, and help them develop qualities such as honor and loyalty. Among the accumulated souvenirs of the past 50 years is a small booklet with a Phalanx shield on the front and my name on the dedication page. The introduction tells how the Phalanx was started. In the early fall of 1935, Fred Fletcher, then Secretary for Young Men at the South Chicago Y, decided that some means must be found for preserving the ideals of fellowship and civic responsibility fostered by school clubs and high Y groups. Graduates and members who had outgrown the aforementioned organizations found themselves without a more mature group or leadership to which they might turn for information and enlightenment. After a thorough study of the problem and various solutions, Fletcher called together 10 young men and organized the first Chicago chapter of the Phalanx Fraternity. This was the birth of a Phalanx movement in YMCAs throughout the city and state, and in the past year, 1936, it has spread westward to the Pacific Coast. Working with the young men in the promotion of an educational program regarding problems of importance to them was no easy task. Differences of opinion on minor problems many times caused personal feuds which threatened to split the chapter into two separate groups or disband it entirely. Time, the great healer, and a more mature viewpoint as the result of the educational nature of the club's programs served eventually to weld the warring factions into an even stronger unit than it had ever been. The book also lists the names of the young men who made up the club: Robert G. Cote, Otto A. Kirsten, William Schmaltz, Walter C. Dalzell, Ted DeBauer, Gene Lutz, Wally Kneisler, Al O'Connor, Elmer Nutter, Michael Savage, Erwin Laube, Ira Kingsmill, Sherman Swanson, George and Nick Ovosevich, Arthur Oman, Philip Farrell, James Dewar, and Frank Rogan. Some of these young men were first-generation Americans. At least one was an immigrant. The Phalanx became an important part of their lives, and for many of them, it still is. They still have an annual meeting and golf tournament. They still keep in touch with each other. And, as they did in the early 30s when they were finding jobs for club members who needed them, they are still willing to help each other. Gene Lutz has been kind enough to keep me posted on the progress of the boys in the Phalanx Club. Now a lot of them are dead and the rest retired, but there is a happier report of the group in a letter from him in 1976. I'll let him tell you what happened to them. Giacchetti became a millionaire making TV picture tubes. Sherm Swanson served as president of the National Retail Clothiers Association. Cote became president and owner of the S. Beck Meat Company. Don Anderson retired as head taxman of Standard Oil of Indiana. Frank Rogan is also retired after a career as regional sales manager for NCR. Phil Farrow's most recent creation, a large shopping plaza, has been completed in South Holland. This group of South Chicago boys did well in terms of their professions and careers. But, based on the way that they have continued to be strong support for each other, the more important impact seems to be their values. I don't think I have ever seen an organization that accomplished its goals so well. My friend, Mr. Lutz, is, as of this writing, alive and well in Florida, and is about to be married again after a long and devoted marriage to Lorraine. The second important thing, not listed in order of real importance, had to do with Marjorie Irene Lemke, a young lady Y worker from Kewanee, Illinois. She became my wife in 1936 and has been ever since. In a way, the Great Depression, while it was keeping millions out of work and causing a restructuring of the United States government, had a hand with my finding my future wife. When I graduated from George Williams, I stayed in Chicago, continuing my job at the South Chicago YMCA. Marjorie, or Margie, was on the staff there as assistant to the women's director. This is where the depression comes in. Because the YMCA was having difficulty attracting enough members to make its budget, it set up a women's program, letting the women use the facilities in the morning, an action that didn't make the YWCA too happy. Margie, a graduate of the University of Illinois in physical education, was paid $25 a month plus room and board. The YMCA is not a bad place to meet a girl, especially since the first time I remember seeing Margie was at the swimming pool in a bathing suit. I was certainly interested. Although Margie and I lived in the same Y residence, it was nothing like today's co-ed dormitories. There was strict segregation of the sexes, with the married floor separating them. However, we managed to spend a lot of time talking, much of it in the stairwells. I had dated several girls since I had come north, including the niece of the president of the college. However, I had never gotten too serious with any of them. It was different with Margie. Even before we became serious, Margie had a chance to demonstrate what an angel of mercy she could be. I had gone on a Labor Day boating trip on the lake with some of the people from the Y. A storm came up, and we thrashed about most of the day trying to get back in. When we did get in, I was sick with more than seasickness. I was sneezing, I felt achy, and I had a fever. They moved me to the married floor to recuperate, and Margie, bless her heart, nursed me back to health. That, however, was not my primary attraction to her. We dated for about a year. I remember taking her to the Palmer House. She remembers me taking her to Mickleberry's Pancake House, and she has evidence. A menu dated Sunday, December 8, 1935. On that day, you could have lamb chops or homemade southern chicken shortcake with cranberry sauce and mashed potatoes for $1. You couldn't have the frog legs, also a dollar, because they were sold out. You could, however, have a whole broiled lobster or a sirloin steak smothered in mushrooms for $1.50. Mickleberry's was a step or two up from our usual dating. If we ate out, it was usually at a little chili parlor a couple of blocks from the Y at 92nd and Commercial. Much of the time, we ate at the Y and visited with our married friends on the Y staff. I persuaded Margie to take me home with her to Kewanee to meet her parents and her family the Christmas of 1935. They looked me over all weekend, and evidently I passed the test. At least one part of the test for a young man from Raleigh, North Carolina, was getting either enough nerve or enough urgency to go to the privy when the temperature was 2 degrees below zero. After I had traipsed out and back in the snow, I found Margie and her sisters waiting at the door to see how I had weathered the journey. We got engaged at Mickleberry's, and then I thumbed from Chicago to Raleigh to buy the ring. Later, Margie came to Raleigh with me to meet my family. Mother already had someone picked out for me, but she accepted my decision gracefully. Then we went to Washington to see my brother Frank and his wife Beth. We returned to Chicago to stay until the summer. Then I came back to Raleigh, and Margie continued her work at the South Chicago YMCA. On June 29, 1936, while I was in Raleigh and Margie was in Chicago, I took pen in hand and wrote Mr. Fred Lemke a letter asking for his daughter's hand in marriage. Rereading the letter some 50 years later, I see that I didn't bowl the kindly gentleman over with my passion. After a suitably rambling introduction, I got to the point. "Mr. Lemke, Marjorie and I feel that life for us would be quite pleasant if we could spend it together. What I'm trying to say is, I want your oldest daughter's, Marjorie Irene's, hand in marriage. I love Marjorie explicitly. Have absolute faith and confidence in her, and believe she is as fine a girl as ever walked the earth. I may ramble here in getting across some of our plans, but I hope you forgive me on the basis of the excitement I am experiencing while writing this letter." I assured Mr. Lemke that, while we only had about $100 between us, we were both going to work, and that my father was going to subsidize us until I could get my master's in sociology. This last would probably have been news to my father if he had heard it. As it turned out, Margie's full-time job and my part-time job kept us afloat. Mr. Lemke graciously consented to my marrying his oldest daughter, Marjorie Irene. We were married on August 3, 1936. Margie and I traveled to Oak Hill, Virginia, to get married by my grandfather, J. Floyd Fletcher. It was a small wedding, with my grandmother and two neighbor ladies witnessing the ceremony. In fact, I remember Grandma Fletcher telling Grandpa that she had just put the biscuits in the oven. He could start the ceremony. Margie was lovely in a white lacy dress with a cream underslip. The pictures that day showed two young people happily in love without the foggiest idea of what the world was all about. Grandpa Fletcher also offered his services in the nearby creek to baptize Margie into the Baptist church while we were there, but she graciously declined. That would come later. With a family treasury of $250 for a one-night honeymoon, school tuition, rent, and all the other expenses, we began married life. We moved to Chapel Hill, where Margie went to work for the WPA, and I, one more time, went to school. I enrolled at UNC and received a bachelor's and a master's in sociology. I'm a Tar Heel born, I'm a Tar Heel bred, and when I die, I'll be a Tar Heel dead. So it's rah-rah, Carolina, Lina. We lived in a small furnished house on Bryan Lane in Chapel Hill, just behind the Baptist Church. It cost us $25 a month. It was a pretty little house with a fence around it. No gate, just a fence. Until I cut a gate in the fence, Margie had to climb the fence to get out to go to work. But that's a small problem for a young married couple. In fact, when we sat on the front steps one evening and listened to A.J. paint the rosiest of pictures for our future, we really believed him. While I studied sociology, Margie worked with a WPA program in Durham. She would catch the bus every morning, work in Durham all day, and then come home on the bus at night. Between the odor of the tobacco and the fumes of the bus, more often than not, she came home with a real headache. The Durham program, under Mr. C.R. Wood, was already well established, but it wasn't long before she had an opportunity to work with a number of programs that weren't well established. They made her area supervisor for 8 counties. Her job was to work with the local committees in setting up recreational programs. You have to remember that this was during the Depression, a time when there wasn't a lot of money for necessities, much less something that some people looked on as a luxury. Margie spent a lot of time making speeches to local groups, enlisting support, and using whatever was at hand, a school, a church building, a playground, to begin a municipal program. She certainly wasn't alone. The state program, headed by Miss Ronnie Sheffield, had credibility, and a number of local citizens pitched in. There were people like Mrs. Ferry Bandy in Rocky Mount, Mrs. Letty Payne in Henderson, Mrs. Ben Maddox in Smithfield, and others. There are a number of monuments to the WPA still standing. In fact, when you walk on almost any college campus, you'll find a building or two built under the program. But I don't think there's a better monument anywhere than the recreational programs in those counties that Margie covered in our Model A Ford. Every one of the cities that she worked in has an active recreational program, and I would bet that every one of those programs can be traced back to the WPA days. While Margie was busy with the WPA, I wasn't exactly idle. I had gotten a part-time job with the PE department that paid $10 a week. Occasionally, I was hired to judge track meets, a job that, in those days, required a tuxedo. And, capitalizing on my experience as the play-by-play announcer for the Drum and Bugle Corps, I became the PA announcer at Keenan Stadium during football season. In fact, one of my early reviews was a bit in the Durham Sun that noted that UNC had a first-class PA announcer. I took the job seriously. I even developed a board that helped me keep up with who was in the game. Admittedly, that wasn't as hard in those days before the two-platoon system. It was a busy time. Margie working full-time for the government and at being a wife. Fred learning to be a husband, being a full-time student and part-time worker. And spending more time than I should writing letters to the university paper. Margie had some difficulty understanding why she should be on the road while I sat at home writing letters to the editor. I had even more difficulty trying to explain it to her. However, it wasn't long before the point became moot. The Fletcher family was about to go into the radio business. Chapter 5, The Birth of a Station. The WRAL radio and television facility tucked behind the hedges on Western Boulevard gives little hint of the station's humble beginnings. In fact, humble beginnings might be an overstatement. WRAL sort of stumbled into being. For much of the country, the year 1938 was not a good year for beginnings. We were in the tag end of the Depression, and we didn't know that very soon we would be yanked out of the Depression and into wartime prosperity. But the fact that the Depression continued wasn't as obvious in Raleigh as it was in the industrialized cities of the North. If you walked along Fayetteville Street, it was business pretty much as usual. Carolina Power and Light streetcars rumbled down the middle of the street. The state government's payroll was stable. The colleges, State, Meredith, St. Augustine, Shaw, Peace, and St. Mary's, still attracted students. And the city, while it didn't go out of its way to attract the tobacco markets that were going to Durham, Wilson, and other cities around it, was glad to welcome the farmers who came to shop with their tobacco money. The politicians and the people who wanted to impress the politicians gathered at the Sir Walter Hotel, and many of the people in Raleigh had help. In fact, even in 1938, it's possible that the largest single occupation in the city was help, known elsewhere as domestics. The city had stretched as far east as the ballpark on Tarboro Road, beyond Five Points to the north, to State College to the west, and south to the railroad tracks that ran under South Wilmington. We even had an airport, run by a flyer named Truman Miller. That's where Raleigh's first commercial flights came in, and where I took my first flight in 1933 or 1934, I arrived in a Curtiss Condor that had flown to Raleigh from Elizabethtown, New York. Back downtown, the people still bought their clothes at Cross and Linehan, and in the basement of that building were the studios of Raleigh's single radio station, WPTF. Any readers brought up in the days of television probably won't appreciate the place radio had in the homes of the people of Raleigh, Wake County, and the rest of the country in 1938. Just imagine television without pictures. Whole families sat around the radio in the evening listening to news, drama, and music, country, pop, swing, and classical. The difference was that you didn't have to stare at the radio. Readers who came along before television will remember Stella Dallas, Just Plain Bill, Barber of Hartville, The Lone Ranger, The Green Hornet, Mr. D.A., Truth or Consequences, The $64 Question, Inner Sanctum, Your Hit Parade, Stop the Music, The Thin Man, Amos and Andy, Ma and Pa Kettle, Archie's Tavern, Where the Elite Meet to Eat, H.V. Kaltenborn, and Buster Brown, as well as the famous comedians and musicians such as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, and Gracie Allen, Kay Kaiser and his College of Musical Knowledge, and Miller, Goodman, the Dorsey Brothers, Lombardo, Kemp, and the NBC Symphony. They were all a part of our everyday lives, courtesy of radio. WPTF, broadcasting with 50,000 watts clear channel and affiliated with one of the two NBC radio networks, provided radio service for miles around Raleigh and were, so far as they were concerned, the only radio service Raleigh needed. My brother Frank, however, had other ideas. He had been a lawyer with the Federal Communications Commission in Washington. The FCC, in addition to policing the public's airwaves, has the authority to grant licenses for the commercial use of those airwaves. And Frank thought that Raleigh was ripe for another license, a station to compete with WPTF. The fact that nobody in my family knew anything about building or operating a radio station didn't bother Frank. It was true that I had gathered a little broadcast experience during my northern travels, but that was limited to drum and bugle corps programs. He was convinced, and as it turned out, rightly so, that a second radio station in Raleigh would be a sound investment. He even came up with the call letters that would claim the city for its own, WRAL, as in Raleigh. That was somewhat more inclusive than WPTF's We Protect the Family, but WPTF was owned by Durham Life, and they wanted to give a nod to their insurance company. The citizens of Raleigh area that my father brought together to form Capital Broadcasting Company included three other lawyers, Errol Marshburn, Clyde Douglas, and Charles Green, a State College professor, Howard Satterfield, and a builder, E. Johnston Neal. Not a radio man in the bunch. In 1938, the competition for broadcast licenses was not as keen as it is today, or was when we applied for a television license in 1953. Today it requires a battery of lawyers, preliminary hearings, settlement conferences, hearings, and appeals. you also have to have a herd of highly paid experts with charts and graphs. Fortunately for me and the rest of my life, 1938 was a simpler time. WPTF objected to a new license for Raleigh, but not much. A temporary AM license was granted for a 250-watt station on July 28, 1938, and my family was in the radio business, sort of. As noted earlier, I had spent some 9 years in various schools, colleges, and universities. I had gotten my bachelor's and master's degrees at Carolina and was considering a job teaching sociology in college. In fact, I had an offer from a small Southern women's college. They would pay me $1,400 to start. AJ offered me $20 a week and the title of education director for the new radio station. I jumped at it. Not only did radio seem to be an exciting profession to be in, but I was also going to work for my father. I didn't think being the boss's son would be all bad. And Margie, who had been supporting us with her WPA job while I was at Carolina, didn't think it would be all bad either. She thought, and I agreed, that it was time for us to start a family. For those who don't know what the educational director of a radio station does, the first thing he does is collect $2 more a week than a staff announcer. Then he develops broadcast programming with the schools and colleges in the city, putting their musical organizations, discussions, and debates on the air. If I had been smarter or more experienced, I probably wouldn't have been so quick to jump. But, as somebody said, where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise. I didn't even stop to think about our competitive position. In Raleigh, there was, of course, WPTF, with all that power, the NBC affiliation, and announcers with deep announcer voices. Over in Durham, there was WDNC, the CBS affiliate, also powerful, also staffed with announcers with deep announcer voices. I don't think our position really struck home until one day, while we were building our transmitter and putting together our studios, I went to WPTF to be interviewed by J.B. Clark. WPTF, having accepted the fact, probably without a lot of worry, that they were going to have a 250-watt competitor, had done the courteous thing and invited me, as a representative of the new kid on the block, over to tell their vast listening audience about it. I was more than a little nervous. I don't remember much about the interview, except one question near the end of it. I remember being acutely aware that J.B. Clark had a deep announcer voice, and my own, even though I'm a baritone, sounded strangely high and thin. Then he asked very kindly, "Mr. Fletcher, how much experience do you have?" I think I said, "I don't have any experience, but I'm going to get some." As soon as I could, I got out of the studio and into my car. I had to go pick Margie up, and as I waited in the parking lot for her, I cried. I didn't have any experience, and I wondered whatever made me think I should try to get some. Fortunately, putting a radio station together doesn't leave a lot of time for reflection. I was soon too busy to worry about it. We were involved in turning our temporary license to broadcast into a real radio station. AJ bought the building at 130 Salisbury Street for WRAL's studios. Kenny Fogg's Statehouse restaurant was downstairs, and we were upstairs. WRAL's first home consisted of a couple of studios, a reception area, offices for the manager and the salespeople, and the record library, stocked with every record we could buy, borrow, or otherwise acquire. The ambiance was usually supplemented by the aroma of whatever the State House was serving that day. By today's standards, or even by 1939's standards, the studios were pretty Spartan, functional but not luxurious. We did, however, have all new equipment, simply because there was little used radio equipment to be had. We put our transmitter out in East Raleigh on the East Davie Street extension behind what was then called the Union Cemetery, so called because it first held the remains of Union soldiers. Now it's the Raleigh National Cemetery. We also, and none too soon, hired somebody with real radio experience. AJ lured George T. Case from WDNC in Durham to be the station's first general manager. His wife, Mary Lou, came to work with him. On March 20, 1939, we threw the switch on our 250-watt transmitter. Governor Clyde Huey and Mayor George A. Isley were on hand for our first broadcast, and the News and Observer reported that Promptly at 7 o'clock last night, Raleigh and vicinity heard a new voice on the air. The Reverend Sidner L. Steele, pastor of Raleigh's First Baptist Church, offered up a prayer for the new enterprise. So much for the people who said we didn't have a prayer. Remember when Olivia Rainey Library was the only library in Wake County and was located at the corner of Salisbury and Hillsborough Streets? Chapter 6. He Held the Lantern. In the 50s, when television became popular, everybody connected with the movies moaned and groaned about how television would kill the movies. I don't remember anybody moaning that television would kill radio. It didn't, but it sure did change it. In Raleigh today, there is a radio station for almost every taste. Rock and roll, easy listening, religious, country music. In some places, it's cut even finer than that, with talk stations, Spanish stations, all news stations. There may even be a station somewhere that specializes in water sports. In any event, radio is not what it used to be. The radio soap operas like Stella Dallas are gone. The dramatic shows are gone. And our dependence on radio for news is gone. Most of all of that has gone to television. In 1939, when we started, radio stations tried to appeal to everybody. And everybody had a wide variety of tastes. Since we didn't have a network affiliation, we subscribed to a syndication service, Langworth Library and Associated Services of New York City. They supplied 16-inch transcription discs of dance band music, and in those days, dance bands and jazz or swing bands were often one and the same. We had the Columbia Masterworks series for classical music and Trance Radio Service for national and international news. The news came clattering in on a ticker tape machine like you see in the old movies. For local news, we hired W.C. Hendricks, a local newspaper reporter. He started with us part-time, covering City Hall, the police beat, and about anything else that could happen in a city the size of Raleigh. W.C. was the city's first local radio newsman, and his 15-minute News of Raleigh eventually became the highest-rated radio news show in town. It wasn't terribly sophisticated, but it was radio, and it was local. Even in those days, radio stations made their living by selling advertising. That was a real challenge when you represented a new 250-watt station in a market dominated by a 50,000-watt station. Fortunately, we found a salesman, Bob Zeely, who had more than enough skill to peddle our advertising. Sometime after that, we added Lynn Stevenson, Raleigh's first radio sales lady. I suppose life is easier now that stations can take nearly all of their broadcast day off of a satellite or big reels of tape, but I can't believe that it's as much fun as we had. What station today, for instance, would play a song with a title like, "He Holds the Lantern While His Mother Chops the Wood," or "Flatfoot Flugey with a Floy Floy," or "Your Baby Has Gone Down the Drain Pipe," and play it in the same program with a lovely piece of light classical music? We did it, and in those days, nobody thought it was unusual. I still have a brochure that we published in 1941 that gives some of the flavor of the programming. This is, of course, after we were all of 2 years old and had not only worked some of the kinks out of the programs, but had attracted very talented staff people like Ray Reeve. I had, by this time, through dedication, hard work, and having the same last name as the owner of the station, risen to general manager. In fact, one of the most naive statements in the brochure is the caption under my picture. It says, "He conducted radio programs over station WWAE. This background undoubtedly accounts for his interests in radio and his present position with WRAL. Sure it did. By 1941, we had also joined the Mutual Broadcasting System and had the audacity to put the voice of the capital city on our brochure. According to the brochure, our local staff consisted of Larry Roller, program director and announcer, Ray Reeve, sports and special events, Tom Latimer, and Frank Mansui. One of the things that strikes me, other than how amazingly young everybody looks, is that everybody is from somewhere else. Larry was from Ohio. Ray had worked in Honolulu, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore. And Frank was from Scranton. Only Tom Latimer, being from Dunn, was reasonably local. I also noticed that we talked funny back then. Under Tom's picture, it mentions that he entered radio because 2 years ago a decision was reached that medicine was not for him. This may or may not have meant that he flunked out of medical school. It also mentions that Frank annexed Marie J. Van Bergen as his bride. In the MBS section of the book, there are pictures of MBS commentators Wythe Williams, looking for all the world like W.C. Fields, Fulton Lewis Jr., and Raymond Graham Swing. Sports coverage was provided by Red Barber and Bob Elson. For entertainment, Mutual provided us with shows like The Shadow, as in The Shadow Knows, Helen Holden, Government Girl, and Bulldog Drummond, with entertainers like comedian Henry Morgan, and musicians such as composer-conductor Morton Gould, singer Marion Clare, bandleader Tommy Tucker, and the Steele Sisters, identified by the copywriter as Three Little Packages of Harmony. Another show that came down from MBS was a comedy called The Johnson Family. The Johnson Family consisted of 22 family members, all played by one actor, Jimmy Scribner. The MBS segments were just part of our programming, about 30 hours a week in mid-morning and in the evening. The rest of the time was all ours, and we filled it up as best we could. The local programming was varied. We had an early morning gospel show, 5 minutes of news at the top of the hour, various musical shows, game shows, and sports events. The musical shows ran the gamut, from novelty to classical. In fact, in the middle of the morning, we had a show of nothing but novelty tunes. The show was called The Bald-Headed Duck. At 1:30, we had another musical program called Music for Memories, primarily made up of show tunes. Then at 4 o'clock, when the teenagers were home from school, we featured the local pop records on a show called Hotspot, hosted first by Ray Reeve, then by Red Monroe. Ray's sign-off is still remembered by a lot of people who were teenagers in the early 40s. At the end of the show, he always intoned, "The platters were here, and they're gone. Yes, the platters were here, and they're gone. We're sorry, Gate, if you tuned in late, but the platters were here, and they're gone." Late at night, Earl Shaw serenaded lovers and would-be lovers on Dreamtime. This was the first nighttime request show in the market, coming years before WPTF's Our Best to You. Sometime later, after Paul Montgomery had joined the staff, we had another DJ show that combined pop tunes with what Paul and his accomplice, Tom Wright, claimed to be wit. The name of the show was Spinner Sanctum, subtitled Just Plain Bull. The names were, of course, a takeoff on NBC's Inner Sanctum and the soap opera Just Plain Bill. The content was a takeoff on almost anything they could think of. In one show, for instance, Paul says in his best Ray Reeve voice, "And here's Tom Wright with color." Tom, of course, says red, green, blue. Well, it was funny at the time. Except for Your Hit Parade, there wasn't a lot of information on what was popular in pop tunes. Nobody could have a top 40 radio station in 1941 because nobody could really tell you what the top 40 or even the top 20 records were. We got most of our information either from our advertising sales representatives in New York or from Jimmy Thieme and Charlie Stevenson, owners of two of Raleigh's music stores. One particular song that I remember was Near You by Francis Craig. Jimmy Thieme called and told us we ought to be playing it, that it was sure to be a hit. We ran right out and bought a copy of the record. Paul played it at least 6 times that day, and people kept calling and asking him to play it again. It did, of course, become a hit. Looking at our 1941 brochure, I'm amazed at all of the places we went for our remote broadcasts. In those days, any remote had to be fed back to the station via phone lines, but that didn't keep us from taking WRAL all over Raleigh. There is, for instance, a picture of Ray and a crowd of people in front of a downtown store. He's conducting an audience participation program called the Tip Spelling Bee. The tip in the title was the name of the sponsor's product, a grape soft drink that was vended in a 6-ounce bottle. Just as in school, if the contestant spelled the word right, he or she won. But in this case, what the contestant won was cash. We also have a picture of one of our Monday evening shows originating from the North Carolina State Penitentiary, then under Oscar Pitts and Ralph McLean. The show featured talent at the prison, some of whom, as the brochure noted, would never see the outside world again. Whatever their situation of incarceration, they put on some spirited shows, and we ran them for several years. The acts included the Four Walls Quartet, Fidlin Fowler and the String Band, Herschel Carver, a lifer and steel guitarist, and Brother Joe Johnson, who did a little preaching using the Saturday Evening Post as his text. An inmate named Bonnie Bondurant did the prison news, commenting on events of interest such as road work assignments. We also went to the steeplechase in Pinehurst, the singing convention in Benson, and to churches all over Raleigh. A number of these remotes were also originations for the Mutual Broadcasting Network. People all over the country heard Ray Reeve announcing the Pinehurst steeplechase, the Benson Singing Convention, the North Carolina Symphonic Orchestra, and the Carolina Playmakers from UNC. Near the end of our 1941 brochure is a picture of the WRAL mobile unit that was, according to the copywriter, kept ready at a moment's notice so that listeners may be informed of emergencies in the vicinity. The mobile unit is a late 30s vintage wooden-sided Pontiac station wagon. Although I don't remember any emergencies that we rushed off to on a moment's notice, I'm sure the station wagon went somewhere. And if there was an emergency, we were ready. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.